Roughly Speaking with Dan Rogics is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy welcomes James Abbott, director and curator of Evergreen Museum. His book, Evergreen, is an intimate portrayal of one of Baltimore's best Gilded Age mansions, a city landmark. Thursday, November 16th at 7 p.m. More at theivybookshop.com or 410-377-2966. The Ivy Bookshop. The right book is waiting.
From the Baltimore Sun in Baltimore, Maryland, I'm Dan Rogics, and this is Roughly Speaking, episode 322 for Friday, November 10th, 2017. Today, we're tackling a subject gaining more of the world's attention, and particularly this week at the United Nations Climate Change Conference in Bonn, Germany. Climate refugees, millions of people who could lose their homelands because of environmental changes coming to the planet.
Right now, about 145 million people live less than 3 feet above sea level in countries like Bangladesh, China, and the Philippines. And scientists predict the world's oceans could rise 5 to 6 feet by the year 2100. By the end of this century, worst-case projections have parts of Boston and Manhattan underwater.
According to a report this week in The Guardian, U.S. military and security experts say the number of climate refugees will dwarf those who have fled the Syrian conflict, bringing huge challenges to Europe in particular. A report of the Environmental Justice Foundation, based in London, says tens of millions of people will be forced from their homes by climate change in the next decade, creating the biggest refugee crisis the world has ever seen. Stephen Cheney, a Naval Academy graduate, retired Marine general, and national security expert said, quote, "If Europe thinks they have a problem with migration today, wait 20 years. See what happens when climate change drives people out of Africa, the Sahel or sub-Saharan area, especially." And we're talking now not just 1 or 2 million, but 10 or 20 million. They are not going to South Africa. They are going across the Mediterranean. On our show today, co-authors of Rising Tides, a book about climate refugees published last summer. Denise Robbins is communications director for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. And Jack Wennerston is professor emeritus of environmental history at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore, and he's the author of several books about the Chesapeake region. In Rising Tides, Robbins and Wennerston address the complex and disturbing challenges ahead. What happens when millions of people lose their homelands because of climate change? Where do they go? Who helps them resettle? And is this great migration, potentially millions of environmental migrants looking to the West for help, inevitable? So my first question, is it too late? Are we at a point where everything you say in your book will likely come to pass, or pretty close to it, in terms of climate change's effect on the peoples of the Earth? Is it already too late, Jack?
It's not too late, but we're reaching a point where things may be beyond our control to influence in terms of the course of events. It's at a critical moment in our evolution as the human race, and whether or not we are willing to recognize that or whether or not we are into complete denial is going to be a crucial issue.
There's a term in your book, climate departure. What does that mean?
It means that we no longer have regular cycles in nature where things were fairly predictable, just as we can say that the summer rains would come, the snows of winter would come. And Camilla Mora, who is a bioregional geographer at the University of Hawaii, came up with the term climate departure. He said, where things are no longer predictable. We can't think in terms of cycles. We can't think in terms of regular patterns in nature. Things are going to come at us very haphazardly, very quickly, and much to our surprise. So welcome to the new era.
After working on this book, how do you feel about that, Denise? You think it's too late?
I think it's definitely not too late. The next several years are going to be absolutely essential for reining in greenhouse gas emissions and acting on climate change in order to prevent a lot of what we talk about in the book. Regardless, climate change is already here in some sense, and it is forcing people to move, and there does need to be a framework of how to deal with climate change refugees, and that framework currently doesn't exist. Regardless of not of whether it's too late, we need to learn how to deal with climate change refugees.
Do we have climate change refugees already in the United States?
We don't call them climate change refugees, but we certainly have people who are profoundly dislocated by changes in climate.
For example?
Hurricanes, Houston, New Orleans, Miami. But this goes back in our history. We had in the 1930s, we had the Dust Bowl, where half of the Great Plains literally blew away, and most of the dust landed on Washington, D.C., unleashing thousands of people moving west to California in search of some kind of sanctuary. So this is not a new thing, climate refugees. We've had them around for quite a while. We just didn't call them that.
You mentioned refugees in Alaska. I'm not surprised to hear you mention Houston and New Orleans, for instance, but Alaska, what's going on in coastal Alaska?
So in coastal Alaska, and I'll also bring in coastal Louisiana, we have several indigenous tribes that, under the Obama administration, actually received assistance to move, to totally relocate their communities. And a lot of people are pointing to them to say that these are the first American climate refugees. Now, under the Trump administration, word is that this program is not really moving at all, but the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the HUD, has allocated tens of millions of dollars to the relocation of tribes, particularly from the Isle de Jean Charles in Louisiana, and similar things happening in Alaska and in the state of Washington. So I will just say that when it comes to talking about climate change refugees in the United States, there's a few different things to think about. It's first of all, we're talking about internally displaced people, not refugee under the UN conventions, under the UNHCR. And in some sense, there is a hesitance to use that term because we don't necessarily want to label people from Puerto Rico, for instance, refugees, because it makes them, it casts them as foreigners,
right,
as they don't belong in this country when they are citizens of this country, and we just need to provide them assistance for relocation. So while we definitely talk about relocation and forced displacement in the United States, it's also worth keeping in mind the difference between that and climate change refugees on the international level.
I was going to ask about Puerto Rico and the U.S. Virgin Islands in the wake of Hurricane Maria. I mean, we could see lots of those people relocate to the mainland, right?
Yes, to the U.S. And to areas that already have had serious disruptions in terms of flooding, such as New York City and Miami.
I want to ask about the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. What exactly has it said, if anything, about refugees?
Forced displacement and migration is starting to become a big source of study in the IPCC and other international organizations. And this document that they come out, which is the framework for the United Nations Climate Conference, is leading a lot of the talks that are happening there right now. So the UN climate talks are happening in Germany this week, and for the first time, they're going to be discussing the idea of putting financing behind a way to address forced displacement. And Paris last year, they, for the first time, coordinated a task force to deal with forced displacement. But the issue is there's no money behind it. So a lot of countries are concerned, you know, it's good that we have a task force. It's good that there are people studying it. But what are we actually going to do about it? So that's one of the topics that's on the table at the UN climate talks this year.
Jack, I don't want to assume that we understand what a scenario is that would uproot people and make them move. I mean, obviously, sea level rise, flooding of coastal areas forces people inland or to actually seek to move to another country, right?
Right.
That seems pretty obvious, but what other ways might it happen?
Drought is a classic example. And also, climate change doesn't take place by itself. It's usually seen you have to look at it in terms of a greater context, like war, changes in technology, dam building, dam bursting, that kind of thing. Changes in infrastructure, all these things contribute to the disruption of populations. I mean, look at the Aral Sea in the Soviet Union. The Soviets decided they were going to raise cotton on what was once a huge inland sea. And all of a sudden today you go there and it's just a salt lake. And that's about all there is. So all of these things bear on climate change. Climate change doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in a context of all a host of other things that are taking place.
My mind went to Donald Trump and his talk of nationalism, his nativist view of things. And then in Europe, what we're seeing with elections and politicians running for office based on nativist, nationalist ideas. At the same time, we're seeing a flood of refugees from the Middle East because of Syria, because of the Syrian civil war. We've seen that in the last 4 or 5 years. But then when you add another layer to it, add climate change, moving people, the more people move, the greater the possibilities for civil strife in their own countries and in this push and shove against the nationalist idea that wants to defend borders, right?
It is really important to talk about what's happening in Europe right now, and especially with the Syrian refugee crisis. That's one of the areas where scientists are pointing to and saying that climate change was one of the root factors in creating this massive refugee crisis. There was a 3-year mega drought, the worst in modern history in Syria, and that caused 1.5 million farmers to get up and leave their lands. They no longer had a viable way of life out there. They moved into the urban centers and clashed with people of different ethnicities for the first time, put a huge strain on the already strained public infrastructure, and created a lot of unrest, which then, of course, led to the president cracking down on protesters, and things spiraled from there. But scientists specifically took a look at that huge drought that caused them to leave in the first place and said that this is because of climate change. It was made 3 times more likely because of man-made global warming.
One of the fundamental problems is, on the one hand, you have the rights of citizenship, the rights of people of various nationalities to protect their way of life and to control their borders. On the other hand, you have an issue of human rights. And it's not a human right to starve. It is a human right to survive. And are we going to say that citizenship rights contravene human rights? This is going to be a real problem. And it's something that has to be worked out in an international context, such as the United Nations operations. And it's currently not happening because the United Nations has problems defining what a refugee is. A refugee is someone who, according to the United Nations, is fleeing political persecution, fleeing a country for his or her life. Whereas there's not a real...
A legal designation for climate refugee?
A legal designation for climate change migrants. And so who's going to take care of them? Who's going to absorb them? Who's going to train them to exist in a different culture? Who is going to essentially care for them medically? These are big problems.
But this is being discussed, right, Denise?
Yeah, it is. And it's interesting to see people shining a light on the limitations of the grounds for refugeedom as they stand right now. You know, they were created in the aftermath of World War II, and climate change didn't really exist back then. And there's very specific rules. There's very specific conventions that you need to be placed under to receive this asylum status. One of the most interesting cases right now is a man in Kiribati that was trying to move to New Zealand recently.
Let's do this. The Kiribati versus New Zealand case, right?
Yes.
This might be the first case of a climate refugee adjudicated?
It was thought to be, and his case was recently denied in the past couple of months. Kiribati is a small island nation in the Pacific, and it is under existential threat of being drowned out of existence.
In the remote Pacific nation of Kiribati, it's already happening. Homes have been swept away by the rising seawater. The government is already making plans for its demise.
This fragile place is on the frontier. The island nation of is in the South Pacific, just over the international date line. It's among the first countries in the world to get a new day, and scientists say it's among the first countries in the world to really feel the effects of climate change due to melting glaciers, rising sea levels, and extreme weather. This idyllic, remote place doesn't seem like it's on the front lines of anything. But when it comes to climate change, it is.
A man searching for asylum in New Zealand because he feels he can't go back home. And similarly to how refugees that are being persecuted for their nationality can't go back home, if he doesn't have a home to go back to, then where is he going to go? So his lawyer actually tried something interesting, which is to say that it was the fossil fuel companies that are persecuting him. And that didn't really end up working, because then the question is, well, why do you want to move to a country that burns more fossil fuels than the one you're leaving?
Because the one he's leaving is sinking?
Yeah.
How was all that resolved?
So he lost his case, and now the lawyer is actually taking it up, a formal complaint with the United Nations, saying that we need to change the definition. So that'll be very interesting to see how that plays out. There have been a couple of other cases of families that did successfully achieve refugee status in New Zealand, but the courts were able to point to additional things like family members that supported their case. So there's no basis for someone becoming a refugee solely due to climate change yet. But also in New Zealand, the climate change minister is trying something new, which is an experimental program to issue visas for climate change refugees, people that are displaced from climate change. It's just in the experimental phase going to be 100 visas a year, but it'll be really interesting to see how that goes, if they feel like that's something that can be replicated in other countries or dialed up in New Zealand.
Jack, what gave you the idea for the book Rising Tides? What were you looking at surveying that made you want to write this book?
Well, I spend a considerable part of every year in India. I have family there, and I go over there both as a journalist and a scholar and as a family member. And seeing the impact of various climate changes really sparked my interest in pursuing this matter further. And also, as I began looking at things happening in India, for example, the Indian monsoon is getting increasingly erratic. Sometimes it dumps the whole monsoon on the Bay of Bengal rather than on land. And so places that never had water shortage are now having water shortages, like my son's town of Chennai, formerly Madras. He has to buy his water during lean times from a water truck. But I was also fascinated and indeed somewhat concerned over the fact that how scientists talk among themselves. There's a kind of loop of scientists talking to themselves rather than throwing out the interesting things that they're doing into the general communications pool so that the average guy on the street could understand it, which is why Denise and I wrote this book, something that the average person could read and understand, because a lot of this stuff is encapsulated in scientific journals.
So scientists talk about the potential for human unrest and refugees because of climate change.
Anthropologists, demographers, yeah. And scientists. Yeah.
And military experts.
I'm sure they do, yeah.
Oh, yeah. They're military experts are on the money. I would say that...
They're on the cusp of a lot of things.
Yeah.
Right. They are.
I think that if you said that who's most interested in climate change today in the United States, I would say the military establishment. Whether it's what's going to happen to the Navy base in Norfolk because of rising tides, what is going to happen to national security with global unrest and migration, they're on top of this. They're the one group that says, we know climate change is real.
Can we talk about this in terms of regions? Asia, for instance, when you mentioned India, but when you look at the rest of Asia, what do you see there?
The easy trigger to understand is what happens to Bangladesh. As Bangladesh goes, so goes a lot of the subcontinent, because Bangladesh is almost all at sea level. And with 15 million possible refugees coming out of Bangladesh, you say, well, they'll flood into India. But India is now building a huge wall fence. It's not just the Trumps of this world that are building fences. And so that's going to be a trigger as to what is going on. Big fights are going to emerge between India and China over access to water, because the watersheds in the Himalayas are controlled by the Chinese, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, for example, and there are going to be great conflicts about access to water. And to a great extent, drought is becoming a major factor in Indian politics.
Asia definitely has the most at stake in terms of population and financial assets that are at risk of sea level rise. There are huge urban centers that are just on the coast in many different countries, and overwhelmingly they are going to be the worst impacted by sea level rise and among the least prepared to withstand it. And further inland, though, you know, in Russia, we've already seen droughts and wildfires have implications across the globe in terms of food prices, bread prices, that led to some uprisings in Africa and possibly connected to the Arab Spring. So there's not one singular event that will be most felt in Asia. There's a lot to deal with.
How about in Latin America?
Well, we're seeing the deforestation of the Amazon, which is having a profound effect on how climate is changing. But the big issue will be not necessarily there, but in Central America. We're already seeing in Nicaragua and parts of other areas of Central America water problems, water shortages. Went through my notes and got some statistics on how many people were affected by drought in Latin America, and I got 4.5 million. That's 4.5 million suffering from drought in just in the Central American countries. And this is producing climate refugees who can no longer work on the old banana plantations because they don't have enough water access. And the aquifers, don't think in terms of deserts when you think of Central America. Think in terms of the available aquifer, the available water supplies. And as these supplies get increasingly diminished, the economy is going to have to adapt to these diminishing changes. And it's going to cause a lot of people to jump on the top of the train and head to El Norte.
I can think of no other topic more pressing, no other topic that calls for the United Nations to be at the top of its game and to actually function the way in the ideal it should function. And it is in dealing with the effects of climate change on human populations.
Right. Look at the dilemma that Robert Sisslow finds himself in. Robert Sisslow is the ambassador of the Solomon Islands to the United States. In the past, the Solomon Islands was the atomic bomb playground of the United States military. Now, suddenly, the United States government is very reluctant to sort of develop any policy with regard to what's going to happen to the Solomon Islands. A lot of these people out on the Solomon Islands are citizens, but the Solomon Islands now has its own independence and its own way of life, and they are almost all at sea level, the Solomon Islands. People think, oh, let's go to Truk. Truk is a nice place for skin diving and scuba diving.
But your point there about the Solomons is that we may have to accept responsibility for that population? Or
I think so. We're going to have to accept responsibility.
And when we say we, do we mean the United States or do we mean internationally?
I think, you know, we're going to have to accept responsibility internationally. And this is an international problem. No individual sovereign nation can solve the problems engendered by climate change, whether it's fossil fuel agreements or things of that sort, or the exchange of migrant populations. No one country can do it alone. But the United Nations is an interesting place. It doesn't move very quickly. And it's a nice sinecure for many people coming from the developing world. And they don't want to essentially get into trouble with the developed countries in terms of articulating policies that are going to be offensive.
The richest polluting countries are the ones that need to do the most to rein in emissions and to also help the poor countries that have nothing to do with climate change, yet are the first to face the impacts of devastating hurricanes and sea level rise.
Now look at the timing. I mean, I'm glad you've written your book. I think it is an important warning call to everybody, but it comes in the time of Trump and this America First agenda and, you know, building walls and closing the borders and this nativist nationalist rhetoric that we hear from him. Yeah. And climate change denier, too. This is a president who called it a hoax.
It's called the armed lifeboat.
The armed lifeboat?
Yeah. We're in our lifeboat, and we are armed. The Trump administration said it was willing to allow 25,000 refugees into the country. And that's just a pittance.
It lowered that limit from 100,000 or 110,000 that was set in the Obama administration.
Yeah. Yeah. And in the past, we've taken large numbers of immigrants. During the Vietnam War, we ultimately took in over 1 million Vietnamese, you know, about 250,000 Cambodians. And now we're talking about, you know, five-figure admissions.
You know, the Trump administration can't stop the science or can't stop the facts. The big national climate assessment just came out under the Trump administration, and it raises a lot of alarms that he himself, I'm sure, wouldn't say or allow his officials to say. But these reports have been in the works for years, and the national climate assessment was leaked a couple of months ago to the New York Times, I think to make sure that it wouldn't get stifled by the administration.
I don't think there's any denying it, not here, not in this room, but not among a lot of people.
Yeah.
But, you know, how do you get the attention of this particular leadership? I think you have to wait until the Trump storm passes, and we don't have time. You know, that's valuable time that could be put into solutions and actually taking the lead on finding solutions with the United Nations. But you have an administration that I don't think respects the United Nations and seems to be in denial about climate change. Not seems to,
you know,
is.
In the meantime, though, if every other country in the pact moves forward and if all of the states in the United States that want to continue to move on their own terms to achieve the emissions reductions under the Clean Power Plan, even though the Clean Power Plan isn't currently in effect. But we're seeing so many more local and state policies, leaders really stepping up to take more action on climate change than I think they would have before Trump was elected, because they know it's not going to happen at the federal level right now. So we really just actually got to take it into our own hands and move forward on local and state policies.
Jack, just to bring this around here, the Chesapeake Bay to Baltimore, we're seeing some sea level rise along our coast and in the bay. We're also seeing some of the land falling, too, at the same time.
Yes.
Subsidence. So looking in the long term, 40, 50 years down the road, there's been some projections on that. What do you see?
In the Chesapeake, the major brunt of climate change will be experienced by the eastern shore of Maryland and Virginia. Already they're having massive amounts of saltwater intrusion into places like Blackwater Refuge. Places that were once freshwater marsh are now turning into saltwater marsh, and trees are dying and the marsh is being transformed. So that is happening. Closer to home, here in Baltimore, a 3-foot rise or a tidal surge could disrupt the sewage plants, for example. We never think of where it goes when we flush the toilet, but it goes somewhere. And indeed, this will be a real problem as we have rising seas. And then also, with rising seas, we have the disruption of the infrastructure. For example, most railroads in Washington and Baltimore are built very close to the mean high tide watermark. So we could have a disruption of transportation.
And some go through tunnels.
Yes.
So, Jack, if I could put you on a podium where you could address the world, what would you say to the world?
It's an international problem, and it's a problem that is not insurmountable. We, as a people who have dealt with things like the absorption of the Holocaust refugees after World War II, we as a country who have welcomed millions of immigrants over time, are currently denying essentially the realities that are being brought forward to us. And so I would say to the American people that we have to have an international effort. We have to begin to develop standards. We have to be able to develop transit passes. We have to be able to deal with situations that are novel. For example, what happens when someone's country drowns and they no longer have a country? Are they a citizen of what? Are they a citizen of the ocean? Are they a citizen of the United Nations? So we need some kind of standardization of processes that will allow us to deal with this problem. What we don't need is more walls being built.
The subject of your book is being addressed, right?
In a task force. It is okay. Being addressed in a task force. So it's not at the forefront of conversation, but I do believe it's one of the more contentious issues that will be discussed in the next couple of
weeks. Or is it contentious? Is there some question about just how bad it could be?
The question is money. The fact that to actually address these issues, you need money. And right now there's a task force and there's something called the Warsaw International Mechanism for Loss and Damage.
Okay,
and
but
doesn't
there, there isn't a dispute about whether there will be climate refugees.
Correct.
The big, big number is going to be Africa and the Sahel. There's a heat belt across the planet, and the Sahel is right in the midst of that heat belt where amazing droughts are taking place. 14 million people. Try to imagine 14 million people on the move. And some things are so stupidly simple that could have been put in place, like the massive planting of trees in areas that are still having adequate rainfall. But we didn't do that. And of course, what trees were left were being chopped up, being used by poor people for firewood and cook fires and things of this sort. So the simple act of planting a tree, to a great extent, could help solve these problems. But as I said, we are delusional and we are afraid to give up our extra Pepsi Cola, our extra piece of pizza. And I dare say that if we took a 10% reduction in our standard of living, we wouldn't miss it. We're all a little on the heavy side. We're all eating too much. We're all drinking too much. We're all consuming too much. We're all caught up in the philosophy of more. And if we did this, if we began sharing GNP, this would go a long way to solving the problem. And this is something that countries like Sweden are talking about. How much of our GNP shall we contribute towards these climate change refugees?
Instead of just being an armed lifeboat.
Yes.
Denise Robbins is Communications Director for the Chesapeake Climate Action Network. And Jack Wenderson is Professor Emeritus of Environmental History at the University of Maryland Eastern Shore and author of several books about the Chesapeake region. They are the co-authors of Rising Tides, Climate Refugees in the 21st Century, published by the Indiana University Press. More information available in the notes with this podcast. And that's our show for now. For producers Steve Early, Quinn Kelly, and Christina Tasek, this is Dan Rodericks here at the Baltimore Sun. Thanks for listening to Roughly Speaking. Please review the show on iTunes if you get a chance. And we'll see you again soon. Have a great weekend.
Roughly Speaking with Dan Rodericks is brought to you by the Ivy Bookshop, an independent bookstore at Falls Road and Lake Avenue in Baltimore. The Ivy stocks a wide selection of books covering Baltimore and the Chesapeake Bay region, many by local authors. Located at 6080 Falls Road, more information can be found at theivybookshop.com or by calling 410-377-2966.